Thanks for joining us at Cults to Consciousness. This storytelling podcast is meant to be for entertainment purposes only and does not substitute for any medical advice. We may discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. Lastly, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the host.
It came out that he had been abusing her since she was like 4 years old, that it was extremely extensive. And my sister admitted this to the bishop. And ultimately, the bishop decided to keep this a secret from the authorities, but also my parents. Because at the time, my brother was a year into his mission. And the bishop felt like it was just far too embarrassing to bring a Mormon missionary home early because of CSA charges.
Yeah.
And so he did nothing. Yeah. And kept it a secret from my parents too, which just allowed for the abuse to thrive in my childhood home for years longer. My parents were going to start a lawsuit against the church for a breach of fiduciary responsibility, but they ended up settling out of court with the church for $150,000.
Hey, my name is Shalise Ansola, and this is Cults to Consciousness, where we discuss leaving high-demand religions or organizations and finding healing and independence through awareness and true individual sovereignty. As always, if you're only listening and you want to see our faces, head on over to our YouTube channel at Cults to Consciousness, where you can join in on the conversation, leave those words of encouragement for our guests who are coming on and bravely sharing their stories with you, become a subscriber and advocate for these people as well, and it just really means a lot when you're willing to interact and help the algorithm a little bit. So today's guest, I found her through this article on the Daily Mail by Miles Dilworth. He was exposing a bunch of child SA cases within the mainstream Mormon church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We will be saying either LDS for short or Mormon for short, just so that's not confusing and it's a little bit long, the other one. Within these cases, it was illustrated, and these are all court cases as well, that the church frequently mishandles abuse within its membership. So people coming to the bishop, confessing sins that are not reported to authorities. Sometimes this abuse continues, it perpetuates because it was mishandled. And our guest today was actually one of these cases within the article. So I was able to get a hold of her, and I'm so grateful and happy that she's willing to come on and share her story with us. So thank you so much for joining us, Katie Wallace.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here to be able to share my story.
Yeah, it really means a lot, truly, when people are willing to open up about something so sensitive and share. I think it really helps a lot of people feel validated and seen in maybe their own traumas or family members, and it helps them relate to them in a different way and feel more compassion. So we cannot thank you enough for being willing to come on and share with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. So throughout this episode, we will probably be abbreviating CSA as to avoid getting triggered by the algorithm in YouTube. That's not to say we don't want to say the words that are very important. We can put them in the comments so that you guys know what we're talking about, but I think it'll be pretty obvious. If we do say out the entire word, sometimes we get flagged, and we want to make sure this video reaches as many people as possible to continue to raise awareness. So CSA is what we're going to be trying to use throughout. So let's talk about your childhood specifically, kind of where you grew up, the dynamic within your family, and how Mormonism played a role in that.
Yeah, I grew up in Arvada, Colorado. I've been a member of the church since I was a child. My parents were converts to the church. But yeah, I was born into it. And it was definitely a huge part of our childhood. My family was extremely active, like church every single Sunday, family home evening on Monday. You know, we went to all the church activities, and it was a huge part of our childhood. As I grew up, did the Mormon trek and seminary.
Oh, the trek.
And, you know, oh yeah, the trek was fun, except that I got hurt on the very first day of trek.
Oh no. So for those who don't know, real quick, the Mormon trek is where we actually did an entire episode on this, and it's pretty awful, but it's a recreation of the Mormon pioneers who basically settled Utah. And specifically, the one that we recreate is one with the hand carts where you have to pull your cart yourself miles and miles. And the kids do this. It's like a teenager thing. And you wear the bonnets and the old-fashioned dresses and you cook your food. And it's if you watch the other episode that we did on Trek, the handcart companies that we were emulating actually did not need to suffer or die off or any of those tragic things that happened. It was basically because of money and greed that these people died. So it's really problematic in my mind that we're recreating this event that didn't need to happen. But anyway, yes, Trek was a big deal. How did you get hurt on yours?
I got the position behind the hand cart, pushing the hand, my family's hand cart, and, you know, pushing along the trail with a hand cart in front of you. You can't quite see what's in front of you.
Yeah.
And there were gopher holes all through the trail. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to step straight into a gopher hole. It was like 2 hours into trek and twisted my ankle. And so I was hurt for the rest of the time. I didn't get to walk with my family. The rest of that day, they actually made my family carry me in the hand cart just so they'd have the experience of what it was like. Yeah. So real fun.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So yeah, you are deeply invested in the Mormon culture to be going on trek and doing all the things. You probably went to Young Women's on Wednesdays.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Young Women's, all the activities. I did baptisms for the dead when I was like 13 years old. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely very, very active Mormons. It definitely played a role in my family life. You know, my parents... obey your parents. Mm-hmm. They were very strict, authoritarian style parents. You know, there really wasn't any questioning. You know, the priesthood authority was real strong in my household. My father was definitely the head of the household, and he tend to play a role where we were kind of fearful of him. Just very strict rules. You know, I mean, the typical, not allowed to go do anything on Sundays, you know, really careful about what we were allowed to wear, you know, who we were friends with, how we spoke, just, you know, typical Mormon stuff. Mm-hmm. I think that there was a dynamic in my household that kind of played a part for abuse to thrive. I kind of hate to say it this way, but my mother was a bit of a doormat. She was very submissive, would kind of, you know, bow down to my father and his whims and his, you know, will. And he was kind of a scary figure in our household sometimes. He was often the punisher, but he wouldn't punish us girls. That was typically left for my mother, but he was very strict with the boys, extremely harsh in his punishment with the boys. And that made us girls also fearful of him because, you know, we could hear what was going on in the house. We could see what was happening. And so it kind of just created an environment of strict obedience, authority, and fear within our household. Mm-hmm. It was a big family. I came from a family of, there's five siblings. And my mother, you know, had very little education. She ran a daycare business at home. And so she had her hands full with the kids and daycare and the household stuff. I mean, very strict gender roles. And I mean, that's very typical in Mormon families where a man is essentially the provider and the woman seems to care for everything else. All the emotional labor in the household, the finances, I mean, just everything seemed to fall on my mom. And so my mom definitely was really overwhelmed. I think she dealt with a lot of depression in my childhood home, which, I mean, there's a lot of studies coming out of Utah where that seems to be really common in Mormon homes, that mm-hmm. there is a really big problem with depression and mental illness. And I think that's probably partially because of a lot of the pressures that the gender roles and the church structure and everything puts on men and women, women especially, mm-hmm. we are the caregivers and we care for everything. And that was definitely my mother. And because of her being really overwhelmed and depressed, she became a rather neglectful mother. Mm. There was a lot of abuse in the house, verbal and mental abuse, some physical abuse, and just a ton of neglect. I mean, from a really young age, we were kind of off on our own doing whatever. There were times when my mother would be so overwhelmed and not feeling well that she'd lock us out of the house.
Really?
Yeah. So there was an awful lot of neglect, which I think played a part in some of the abuse amongst my siblings and I. I think that it created an environment amongst my siblings where we were completely out of control. Like, we didn't have control over so much within our own lives that I think that it was all of us kids trying to find and take control over some part of our life. And I think that also within Mormon families, the big families, lots of kids, it gets to a point where a mother and a father just cannot provide all of the needs for all of the children. Mm-hmm. And so then you have older children taking care of younger children. And then, of course, with the priesthood, I mean, young boys start getting the priesthood fairly young. And so then they're also in a different position of authority. So there's all these power dynamics, I think, that kind of play a role for allowing abuse to thrive within kids' homes within the church.
Yeah, definitely. And let me just add a little bit of context for those who aren't familiar with Mormonism. So were your parents going to the temple? Did they go get married in the temple or go through the temple?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were married in the Salt Lake City temple.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So something that I wanted to mention is probably when your parents went through, they still had the verbiage of the woman gives herself to her husband and the husband gives himself to God. So
yeah,
there really is that line of authority. The woman can't really directly go to God. It's just like a very sexist approach. And out of the temples, they'll be like, no, women, you're so important. We need your opinions, but don't talk too loud. And so it's kind of like, no, we love you, but then they do the opposite or show the opposite thing. Or even within church activities, if you have a young woman's activity, there always has to be a man present. The women can't just do anything on their own. And it really sends the message of you're not good enough. You can't do it completely. Like, you're great, but we have the priesthood. And for those who aren't familiar, the priesthood is basically a special power given to boys when they're like 12 years old. And like you were saying, Katie, it creates this kind of superiority thing that makes them feel,
oh yeah,
better, or I have the power of God. And I don't know if any other religions do this, but they're literally saying that holding the priesthood is what it's called, is holding the power of God. So if a priesthood holder, which means basically every guy out there who is worthy and living the laws of Mormonism, all the commandments, all of the rules, if they're not worthy, then the priesthood goes away, apparently. But if you are worthy and you give a blessing, you could literally heal somebody, cure their cancer. And if you don't cure their cancer, it's because either you weren't faithful enough or the person who had cancer wasn't faithful enough, but it's nothing to do with not having the power of God. So it creates this mentality that they're kind of invincible. They can do anything. They can speak to God. And then when it comes to the women, it's very much your job is in the home. And they've had multiple talks saying this. It's not just like me speculating of how they think it should go. There have been multiple prophets and apostles who get up at General Conference, which is the twice a year thing where they tell everyone what God wants you to do. And they say, women, your job is in the home. Your place is in the home. And they don't really encourage higher education because they want you to have as many kids as possible. And If you don't have as many kids as possible, you are cutting off your blessings, and there are children in heaven waiting for you to come down. And I mean, there's a whole movie about it. We've talked about it before, Saturday's Warriors. I don't know if you ever watched that movie.
Yes, I've seen it.
It's like, yes. Oh, it's so cringy.
Yeah.
the whole point of it is just there's another soul in heaven that wants to come down. And the oldest brother is like, Mom, yes. Can you stop having children? It's like her 10th kid or something. And she's like, no, I feel like there's another soul waiting. And the little girl is in heaven. She's like, Jimmy, please let me. It's just so weird.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's like, seriously, how traumatic to think that when am I supposed to know to stop having kids?
Yeah.
Like if there's always the possibility that there's another spirit waiting to be born. I remember so many women in church claiming that they were basically doing their family planning off of dreams they were having. Mm. Like they kept having dreams of more and more babies, and they thought that that was God speaking to them that they needed to have more kids. It's problematic. It is. I mean, I have some crazy dreams. To think that those dreams are true is, it's a little out there.
Yeah, because they teach you about personal revelation. Yeah. And getting revelation from God. And
yes.
Anyway, and let me not to say that you're not receiving some sort of inspiration, divine inspiration. I don't know what's real and what's not. But I think that putting that in a woman's head, especially if, now this is the flip side of that. I mean, it sounds fine to be like, oh, I had a dream that I should have another baby, so I did, and we're blessed and whatever. But on the flip side, maybe you can't have kids. Maybe you're struggling with infertility, and you know that your only job as a woman in the Mormon church is to multiply and replenish the earth, and you can't bring forth children. It creates a lot of harmful things for other women who can't have multiple kids. So I kind of got us off track. You were talking about how you had 5 children in your family and you felt like all of your needs were not being met because your mom probably felt pressured to have multiple kids, and that created this dynamic where you're being neglected.
Yeah. Oh, completely. Yeah. She was just far too overwhelmed. And because, you know, she had to work to financially support the family too, it was too much of a burden for her. And so often the care for the younger siblings came from older siblings. And often the older siblings didn't want to be in a position to care for us younger siblings. And so there was an awful lot of times where I was running around town 4 or 5 years old by myself, like just completely neglected, locked out of the house, you know, and too afraid to go home to even ask for a drink of water or to go to the bathroom. I have a memory of when I was about 5 years old drinking water out of the gutter because I was too afraid to go home to get a drink of water.
Oh, wow.
And I told this story to my mother about 1.5 years ago, and she's like, why on earth would you do such a thing? It's like, well, what else was I supposed to do? I was thirsty. I was too young to realize the dangers of drinking out of the gutter.
Yeah.
But I was too afraid to go home and ask you for a drink. So that's why, you know, it's, so yeah, very neglected, extremely neglected. And being neglected, I think, also put me in a position where I was desperate for love and attention. And sometimes that love and attention came at a really great cost to myself.
So when it comes to your siblings, do you think that your older brothers just started taking it upon themselves to do things to make themselves feel better or to make themselves feel loved? Or is that why you think they ended up doing the things that they did?
I honestly think that it kind of comes down to a loss of control in their own lives. My brothers were extremely abusive, like really violent with us other kids. They would really terrorize us if we were put, you know, under their watch, if my parents were out for like a date night. And my brothers would kind of use this opportunity to really terrorize us. And then they would manipulate us, you know, near the end of the night when it was close to time for mom and dad to come home, they would break down in tears and be so apologetic for their behavior and would convince us to not tell mom and dad. And I think that it was about taking control, but then also kind of manipulating and grooming us kids to just do what they wanted, mm-hmm. to take the abuse and to not report it to mom and dad. And because of the fact that we were so fearful of my parents and their harsh punishment, it made it really easy for us kids to keep secrets for each other. Even though we were being terrorized and harmed, we still loved our siblings. Mm-hmm. We still loved each other and wanted to protect each other from any potential, you know, harm that they would have gotten from my parents. And so we kept secrets. So I kind of think that it was, yeah, a little bit of power, authority, control, and kind of playing out, I think, learned behaviors from my parents.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that was a lot of it. When it comes to the actual CSA, my oldest brother says that he was a victim as well when he was a child. And when it comes to CSA, I mean, the research shows that most people that offend were also victims. It's kind of this vicious cycle. And if nobody gets the help that they need, they don't, you know, it's a hard pattern to break. And so my brother started playing out the same things that he learned with his siblings. And it started with my sister. She was about 4 years old when he started abusing her. Mm. And it went on until she was 11. He started abusing my middle brother, I think about the same time that he also started abusing me. I think he was about 8. I was about 4. And I only remember a couple of instances. I think I was told that from the police report, when my parents pressed charges, that there was quite a bit more that I don't remember. But it went on for about a year before my brother went on his mission. And so he was sent on his mission and the abuse stopped. But it was about a year into his mission that my sister went to our bishop to seek help. She really wanted to get in to see a counselor. And it wasn't because of the sexual abuse with my brother. It was because of all of the abuse in the home from my parents. Mm. She was really terrified of my parents. She said that there were times where my mom was just going crazy and throwing things around the house and just saying the worst things. And she was just really terrified. And so she went to the bishop for help, and the bishop got her in to see a church-approved, unlicensed counselor. And in those counseling sessions, it came out that my sister had been abused by my oldest brother. She only remembers one instance. She has completely blocked out everything else. And in the police report, it came out that he had been abusing her since she was like 4 years old, mm. that it was extremely extensive. But when that came out with the counselor decided that she wanted to have a sit-down meeting with my sister and the bishop to talk about this, to see how they would handle it. And so they did. And my sister admitted this to the bishop. And ultimately, the bishop decided to keep this a secret from the authorities, but also my parents. Because at the time, my brother was a year into his mission. And the bishop felt like it was just far too embarrassing to bring a Mormon missionary home early because of CSA charges.
Yeah.
And so he did nothing. Yeah. And kept it a secret from my parents too, which just allowed for the abuse to thrive in my childhood home for years longer. It was about 3 years after my sister reported the abuse to the bishop that I then started being abused by my middle brother. Mm. And, you know, like I said, CSA, it's a vicious cycle. If you're not getting kids help and they're not properly educated and don't know, then they kind of repeat those patterns. And that's exactly what happened. He started repeating those exact same patterns with me and a younger sibling. And it just kind of spread through our family like wildfire. And then it was about 3 years after I started being abused by him that I finally found the courage to report my oldest brother. It was probably around Easter time in 1995. I was laying in bed at night thinking of my nephews. I had two young nephews by my oldest brother. And my oldest nephew was about the same age that I was when he started abusing me. And I just started thinking about, what if?
Yeah.
What if my oldest brother is now abusing my nephews?
Yeah.
And it broke my heart to think that that was a possibility. And so I kind of broke down into tears, and my mother overheard me and came into the room, and we started talking, and I let her know that I had been abused by my oldest brother, you know, when I was really little. And I didn't know about any of the other abuse from him and some of my other siblings. Mm-hmm. But my mother then went and talked to my sister that night, and my sister then revealed that she too had been abused by him, and that she really wanted my mom to talk to my other siblings to see if maybe they too had been hurt. She then also told my mother that she had gone to the bishop years prior, and they had all decided to keep it a secret. And so then my mother quickly found out that everybody in the home had been dealing with sexual abuse.
Wow.
Everybody. So it had gone through the entire family, and it had really turned my middle brother's life upside down. He was falling apart. He was running away from home. He was using drugs. He was just an absolute mess. And my parents felt like finally they knew what was going on with him. You know, they felt like finally they had some kind of an answer of what was causing him to just go crazy. And so they ended up going to the church, and my parents were going to hold the church responsible. They felt like the mishandling of this abuse, the way that the church decided to keep it a secret from the authorities, but also my parents allowed for this abuse to thrive in my childhood home. That there's the potential that if the bishop had at least told my parents about the abuse, that the rest of us kids could have been educated on all of this kind mm-hmm. of thing, and it could have prevented the further victimization of the three youngest in our family. So the church, ultimately, they took responsibility. I believe our bishop basically confessed to my father that he had mishandled this. And my father fairly quickly got involved talking to higher up in the leadership and the church lawyers, and basically demanding that they start paying for mental health care for mm-hmm. mostly my middle brother. And they agreed. They completely agreed. My parents were not having, you know, they weren't going to go to another church-approved counselor. The first church-approved counselor also failed to report this abuse to. And so my parents were picking institutions and therapists and that kind of thing. And then the church was reimbursing my parents for the cost. But it was a lot. It was extensive. My middle brother spent a lot of time in youth institutions. He spent a lot of time at a place called Cleo Wallace in Colorado. He spent some time at another youth center called AFIC, which actually ended up getting closed down about a decade ago because of child abuse within that facility. And yeah, he did like Outward Bound adventures and therapy and just so much. My parents have said before that they estimate that the church paid out nearly $1 million in mental health care over several years. But it finally got to the point where the church felt like enough was enough, that they had met their restitution, apparently, and they were going to cut my parents off financially. They didn't want to pick up any of the bills anymore. And my parents felt like they owed everything to get me and my siblings any help that we needed. Mm-hmm. And so then my parents were going to start a lawsuit against the church for breach of fiduciary responsibility, but they ended up settling out of court with the church for $150,000. And that was pretty much the end of that. It kind of messed up my father's relationship with the church for a little while. The way that the church handled it, the way that they were kind of going back and forth with whether or not they were going to pick up these bills, the talking with the church lawyer when it came to the settlement. The church lawyer came to him with a $150,000 offer. My dad really quickly decided to go ahead and take it. And then the church lawyer tried to recant on that offer. And so my dad was like throwing scripture at him, like how untrustworthy you are. And basically, yeah. So anyway, it was the way that they handled it was really horrible. It was really disappointing coming from the church. But so it kind of shook his faith a little bit. He was still mentally in, but physically out for about probably almost a decade that he didn't want anything to do with the church physically anymore. Mm-hmm. He's back. He's true believing.
Oh, geez.
So yeah, both of my parents. Yeah.
I will say that I have to give the LDS Church credit for at least footing the bill for what they did. That's more than I've ever heard of in these cases.
That's probably thanks to my father. That's probably thanks to my father. He is stubborn and he is really a force to be reckoned with. And he was not going to let the church back down.
Yeah.
He just wasn't. And they were going, my parents, I think they would have gone as far as making it extremely public if the church didn't take responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I really think that it's thanks to my father that my family got any kind of financial assistance.
Yeah, I think that's amazing that he stood up for you guys like that. And were all of you receiving counseling or just your brother?
The three younger of us, yes, we did end up receiving victim counseling for a couple of years. And I imagine the church was probably picking up those bills too. It was probably partially covered by, you know, insurance. But I imagine if there were any bills, my parents were making the church pick up those bills.
Well, that's good. And I imagine we're going to get to this in a little bit, that it probably has a lot to do with how they handle it now. Because I've heard of many cases where the church has to pay large amounts of money in settlements because their clergy, I mean, if you can really call it that, their bishops are mishandling things. So we're going to get to that in a minute, but I wanted to ask your opinion on this because I'm sure there are people who are maybe thinking, well, maybe it was just a bad bishop and should we really blame the entire organization for this? Do you know if... from all the research you've done or the almost court cases and the settlements and what your parents have told you, do you know what that bishop actually did when he received the information that abuse was going on? Do you think it was just a bad apple situation or do you think the higher ups also had a part in this?
So I don't know for sure. I do know that the church at the time still had their abuse handbook. So he should have had access to that in what the church was telling bishops to do when it came to abuse. I don't know what the abuse handbook looked like back then. My sister believes that the bishop may have consulted also with the stake presidency to try and figure out what to do exactly. But it really ultimately kind of sounds as if that it just came down to what the bishop felt. Right? I'm not entirely sure. Mm-hmm. I can't really say for sure. And I've tried reaching out for this bishop to talk with him. And he of course, will not. I'm sure that the church encourages him not to talk to people right. like me. So it's hard to say exactly what he did. But he sure as heck didn't do a whole lot.
Right.
There's that.
And we can definitely speculate. If I were to make any assumptions, and also the stake presidency is just one tier higher than the bishop, just so everyone is aware.
Yeah.
There's bishops over congregations and wards, and then there's like a group of wards and congregations that another guy, the stake president, is kind of in charge of. So that's as far as it went up the ranks, as we know.
As far as I know.
Yeah, we don't know for sure. But also to add context to why I personally think the bishop was so against doing anything was the mission thing. So he said he didn't want him to be embarrassed. Now, for those who aren't familiar, going on a mission is something that they encourage the youth to do. You've seen them knocking on doors in their white shirts and their little name tags. And they started at that time, they would have been 19 boys and women would have been, or girls would have been 21 going out knocking on doors. But it's something that is highly encouraged, and now it's almost mandatory. They kind of, they're like, no, you have a choice, but not really, because you signed up for this when you were baptized, kind of thing.
Basically.
So, yeah, they kind of guilt and force these kids to go out and preach the gospel and bring in more members to the church. And missions are so incredibly strict, especially back then, where you could only write letters. You could make 2 phone calls a year to your family over the 2 years that you were out, Mother's Day and Christmas. The regime is extremely strict, waking up at 6 a.m., I believe, doing all of the scripture study, going out, door knocking, all of these things. It's really difficult for young kids, and they have all these rules, like you can't swim because the devil rules the waters. And I'm like, what about baptism? I don't know. There's holes in this. They can't have any physical contact with people beside a handshake. Their companion has to be with them literally 24/7 within an eye's distance. You always have to see them unless they're in the bathroom. Someone even said there's a rule about if you shower, you have to clap your hands so that they know you're not doing other things with your hands. I'm just trying to give everyone like a very clear idea of what a mission is. And if you get sent home, it is extremely bad. It is shame on you, shame on your family. Just, it's a bad look.
Yeah.
And so I can imagine the bishop is thinking, we can't do that to this young man. Mm-hmm. Just completely separating himself from the idea that other children have been badly hurt.
Yeah.
And he's trying to protect the reputation. This, I'm just trying to give everyone an idea of where this mentality is, because he would rather protect the reputation of this young boy who is a perpetrator out there door knocking in the world doing God knows what, than the children who are at home who could potentially still be suffering.
Yeah.
So that's, I wanted to give context to why that mentality is the way that it is, and just showing that I think the bishop is also just a part of this society, a part of this mentality where he truly thought that that was the better option, not just on a whim. This guy was like, let's just keep it a secret, because I do think it's a deeper problem than just one person.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. And I think that it wasn't just about protecting the reputation of my brother. I think that he felt like it would be really embarrassing for the church.
Right.
That they sent out a missionary who had been sexually abusing his siblings. Mm-hmm. You know, because to go on a mission, you have to go through a worthiness check. And these men within the church have things like the power of discernment.
That's right.
So how can you find this man worthy and not realize the horrible things that he was doing? And so I think that there's a lot of things. It's not just protecting the reputation of my brother.
That's such a good point.
The mission is important. I mean, the church heavily encourages women to marry returned missionaries. Mm-hmm. And so for him to come home on his mission early, that would have been, yeah, like you said, extremely shameful. I mean, what woman in the church would want to have anything to do with a man who is sent home early from his mission?
So actually, when he did come home then at his scheduled time, mm-hmm. was anything done at that point? Did they know about it at that point?
No, nothing was done. And in the church, they claim that if there is abuse, they put a little annotation in the member's file so that if they move from ward to ward or anything, that it's known, and so that they can't be put in a position working with children, and mm-hmm. so that other bishops know their worthiness and all of that kind of thing. I do not believe that my brother's file was annotated at all. As soon as he returned home from his mission, he was already engaged to a woman he met while he was on his mission, and they were married in the temple less than a year later.
Whoa.
Yeah. So they did not inform her that he had a history of abuse. And clearly his, you know, the singles ward bishop was clueless to his childhood abuse, or they just decided. Did you see the documentary about the Duggars family and their church, uh-huh. and how essentially they felt like they were just marrying him off so that he could redirect his sexual yeah. needs to his wife instead of a sibling? That's kind of the feeling that I got, was that the church, if they knew, if they were aware, they were just like, well, let's just get him married and out of the house so that he's not abusing his siblings anymore. Mm. That's kind of how it felt.
Yeah. And him getting married in the temple less than a year of getting home would mean that nobody knew about this, because generally speaking, when you do something as horrible as this, there's the disciplinary council. You yeah. could get excommunicated. We just talked to a woman named Chris, the episode previous to this, where she was disfellowshipped because she was SA'd at a party brutally. And she was the one that was punished for the, it doesn't make any sense. So the fact that he was able to get married in the temple, because it is extremely hard to get a temple recommend and be, quote, worthy to get married in the temple, it's a huge deal. Yeah. That tells me that absolutely nothing was done or no discipline occurred. Yeah. And if it did, why was it less than what most people would get for, like, for example, for me, for giving a blowjob to my boyfriend at 19 when I was a Mormon? Like, I was told I couldn't go to the temple for a year for that.
Yeah.
Yet we have someone getting married in the temple who has done these horrific crimes. And obviously, it's just weighted in the wrong direction.
Yeah. I mean, since sharing my story publicly, I have had a lot of other victims reach out to me and share their stories as well. And that's a really common theme that I have heard from other victims, is that they faced disfellowship. They faced punishment within the church for their own abuse, their abuser got a slap on the wrist and nothing happened, and they didn't face disfellowship. And some of them have just climbed up the ladder of leadership within the church. So it's really disturbing how victims are often treated within the church.
Yeah, it's so awful. And I know something that you wanted to speak on is how certain things taught within the church, within the doctrine, within the culture, society actually aid in, or I don't want to say promote, but maybe allow this abuse to kind of happen, facilitate this abuse to happen.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so I think that one of the very first things is definitely the structure of patriarchy and authority within the church. I think that that kind of authority is typically abused. It's often abused. Mm-hmm. And when you are giving men literal authority of God, I mean, how do you go against that? And so you want, as someone with faith, you want to believe that these men really do have this line to God and that they were doing what is right. And so it creates an environment that people can be easily manipulated and abused. I think that's one of the big things. I think that definitely the purity and modesty culture within the church plays a big role in abuse. I mean, there's teachings by the church about how, I really love the quote about, you know, girls, you don't want to become pornography.
I can't with that. I can't. By showing your shoulders, yeah. by the way, not by yes. wearing a bikini or something. It's showing your shoulders and your knees.
Showing your shoulders. Yeah. Showing just a little bit too high above your knees, that you are literally becoming pornography. And that creates a lot of shame and a lot of guilt. And then it's often, I've heard so many stories of people who went to their bishop with cases of abuse, and then they're shamed because, well, what were you wearing?
Yep.
What were you doing? And so if I'm to blame for my own abuse, then it's shameful. I want to keep it quiet. I don't want to seek help because I was part of the problem.
Yeah.
It creates an environment where the abuse is very secretive and it thrives. Abuse thrives in the secrecy. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think, yeah, there's too much shame culture within the church, I think. And I think that also when it comes to the purity and the modesty culture, there is not enough sex education within
zero.
Members of the church. Yeah, a
we don't
lot
get anything.
Of members, it really is kind of abstinence only. My parents did not discuss sex with me until I was the age of 10. And that was only because they started doing sex education at school at that time. So my mom wanted to get in the conversation before the school did, but it was minimal. Very minimal information. And even with the school education, it was extremely minimal. And as a child, what does sex look like? Is it just penetrative? Is that what sex is? Or is it all the other stuff? Is it touching? Is it a blowjob? You know, what is sex? And if you are being abused from a really young age, It's kind of like this mental gymnastics of, is this okay? Because I was taught that sex is this and this doesn't look like that. So is this wrong? It's confusing for a kid. It's really confusing for a kid. And so I think that sex education is extremely important to protect kids from abuse. And I also feel like the teachings on no masturbation is really wrong too. I mean, it is a completely natural thing. And you're telling kids that they should not touch themselves. So I can't have sex, which I think is penetrative only, and I can't masturbate, but can I do things with somebody else that's not full penetrative sex and get away with that? Is that a sin? Like, so it just kind of creates a whole lot of these gray areas where I think young people find loopholes to try and skirt around the sin and create abuse. I also think that the encouraging of young people to get married really young and have lots of babies really young is really problematic. I think that it keeps women trapped in abusive relationships. A lot of these women are undereducated and then they start popping out all these babies and they don't have a career. They don't have the finances to take care of half a dozen kids on their own. And so then in cases where they find out that their spouse is sexually abusing their children and they go to the bishop, there's been so many stories of the bishop not reporting the abuse, but encouraging the wife to report the abuse. What a massive amount of pressure to put on a woman who has half a dozen kids to care for and can't even fathom trying to care for those kids on her own. And in a church that teaches forgiveness and repentance. So if a man confesses and he is being repentive and trying to change his behavior, then we should essentially just forgive and move on. The sad reality is that sex offenders do not typically stop that behavior just because they have confessed. And so, you know, typically they will go on to reoffend. And it's really horrible to put the woman in that kind of situation to report that abuse, to try to, I mean, she's battling fear and faith. You know, she wants to have faith in the atonement and forgiveness and repentance and that her husband can change, but also fearful that if she loses her husband, how is she going to survive without him? It puts women in a horrible position that they should not be put in. Bishops that are made aware of abuse should be the ones who are reporting that abuse.
Absolutely. And not only the fear of how is she going to take care of these kids now, but it has eternal consequences in the Mormon theology as well.
Yes.
So if you don't have a worthy priesthood holder, that means you're not getting into heaven, girl.
Yeah.
That woman is supposed to be pulled through the celestial veil, which is the highest level of heaven, from or by her priesthood holder. And if he's not worthy, or if she gets a divorce, who's gonna marry some, in her mind, I'm just assuming, of course there are people who would, but she's probably thinking, who's gonna want me? I have six kids, and how am I gonna find another worthy priesthood holder? Maybe I should just hope that he's gonna change. and hope that he can make it through this repentance process and doesn't do it again.
Yeah.
There's just so many other consequences other than the fear of not being able to take care of her kids because of the pressures that the Mormon church puts on these women.
Yeah. And what does your afterlife look like if your husband doesn't make it into the celestial kingdom? As women, we're often told that, well, we could probably be passed on to another worthy priesthood holder. Like, I don't want to be just passed on to some man that I don't know and be stuck with him for eternity.
Literally reassigned, but also as a plural wife.
Yeah. Yeah, that's terrifying. For my eternity, that's my punishment for just picking the wrong man.
Exactly.
That's horrible.
Exactly. I definitely agree with you and everything that you said. Yes. 100% agree with everything that you said with the boundaries thing and kids not understanding what's abuse because they haven't really been taught or talked to about sex and boundaries and all of that. Yes. And the bishop should be the one reporting. So let's talk about what they're doing now or what you speculate happened shortly after your case.
Yeah. So they've had the abuse handbook for a really long time. I don't know how much it's changed over the years, but they do have some guidelines for like bishops to follow in the cases of abuse. My parents feel as if they're partially responsible for the implementation of the abuse hotline that went into place in 1995. And they really honestly felt like the abuse hotline was a sign of good faith that the church was making real changes, that this kind of thing would not happen again. And so my parents were really thrilled that the abuse hotline came out. It looks good on the surface. It's not really great. And in the abuse hotline or the abuse handbook. So there's definitely some things that I want to talk about. And I've got some notes here. So it says, those who commit abuse in any way are accountable to God, and God offers forgiveness to those who commit abuse when they change their behavior and fully repent. It says those who commit abuse should also be held accountable under the eyes of the law, though. I'm sorry that it's just confessing and repenting. Like I said before, it doesn't stop sex offenders. It just doesn't. They need actual treatment. They need to be held accountable under the eyes of the law. So it should be reported. And the abuse handbook advises that bishops or stake presidents should first promptly call the abuse hotline in every situation of abuse. And there's a section where it discusses responding to abuse. It says that the church leaders and members should fulfill legal obligations to report to civil authorities. Again, that sounds really nice on the surface, that bishops and stake presidency and everyone should do what's legally required, until you learn that over half the states in America, they're not legally required to report abuse. Mm-hmm. They're not. And the abuse hotline, it takes people to speak to church lawyers to tell them what is legally required within their state. And that's so problematic that they're only doing what is legally required of them.
Yeah.
States in the abuse handbook that professional counseling may be helpful in most cases of serious abuse. I don't know why it says that. It may be helpful. Sex offenders should be receiving sex offender therapy and treatment. It should always be advised.
Absolutely.
In cases of abuse, physical abuse, CSA, all of it. They should be getting treatment. I find that ridiculous in the handbook. And then it talks about how members who are convicted of abuse, that their records are annotated so that if they're moved to another ward, that their new bishops are aware. And again, that's great, as long as the bishops are actually doing what is required of them. And there are so many cases within the church of men who were caught abusing children and they've moved on to other wards and convicted of abusing more children. Mm-hmm. So clearly there's plenty of men out there who their files are not being annotated for whatever reason. And so they're just going under the radar and can continue to victimize people.
Or how about the ones who are actually called to being a bishop?
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of cases like that too.
Can we have background checks maybe? What are we doing
here?
Yes,
and that's exactly what I was about to go on to say, is that I really feel that background checks are so important, especially if these people are working in a position of youth. Are background checks perfect? No, not everybody has been caught and they don't necessarily have a background to check. But to avoid doing background checks on people, you're just letting anybody in to work with the youth, and that's mm-hmm. really problematic. I heard a speech by Jennifer Roach. She's kind of a spokesperson for CSA within the church. She was a victim in her evangelical church, and she feels that the Mormon church just handles it so much better. And she wanted to claim that background checks just give people a false sense of security, that if nothing comes back, then, you know, everybody just has this false sense of security. I think everybody within the church already has exactly. a false sense of security exactly. when it comes to their priesthood holders.
Yeah.
You know, we think that these men were found worthy to be given this gift from God. There's already that false sense of security.
Yeah.
So let's do background checks. You know, at the very least, we could be doing that.
I think they did make that a thing in Europe. I want to say...
Yeah, I think I heard about that.
Was it with No Name Noah?
Is that his name? Nemo?
Nemo. I think you're right. I think it was Nemo.
Nemo, yeah. Him and another group of Mormons in, yeah, the UK, I believe it is, were trying to make sure that background checks are done.
Yeah.
And that they're also mandatory reporters of abuse, too.
Mm-hmm.
So great. It's great that the church, people are kind of pressuring the church to make changes in other parts of the world. That's fantastic. I love it. Needs to happen in Utah too. And then also there was another part that the church youth protection training so leadership within the church, anyone who is in a position working with children, they now have their youth protection training that tells youth leaders to report abuse to authorities immediately and then reach out to the bishop who contacts the hotline. I find it really fascinating that the church encourages youth leaders to report to the authorities, but bishops just do what is legally required. And right. I think it's because of the fact that the bishops are protected by clergy penitent privilege and the youth leaders are not.
Mm-hmm.
And so the church has the legal right to hide abuse, but the youth leaders not so much.
Right. And I wanted to talk about, I know you did too, the hotline itself, because this hotline just goes to an attorney's office. It seems like the wrong place to go when you need help with something like this.
Well, yeah. So all the stories that keep coming out about the abuse hotline show that the abuse hotline is just to talk with lawyers so that bishops know what are legally required of them in the state that they're located in. So like the Arizona case that came out, and this case triggered me really badly. It's kind of what got me on this path that I'm on of speaking out against the church, is that, and it felt a lot like my story where, you know, he went to the bishop, he told the bishop what was going on. The bishops ignored it. They called the abuse hotline. In the state of Arizona, they have clergy penitent privilege, so they are not required to report abuse. And so they didn't. And then 7 more years of abuse continued in that household. Those children went through horrific things. I mean, even an infant. It's a heartbreaking story. I don't know how the church cannot feel as if they are culpable in the harm and the continued victimization when they sit back and they do absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. And for that case to go all the way to the Supreme Court and for it to be thrown out because legally they're protected to avoid any kind of accountability in cases like that, it's absolutely heartbreaking. And it's heartbreaking for me because I was led to believe that the church was making changes.
Yeah.
I was honestly led to believe that cases like mine wouldn't happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear that case, I started digging into church abuse cases, and I see that it's common. It's really common. And it's so hurtful to think that this abuse hotline that was put into place that we were led to believe to help and protect people within the church is actually just being used for the church to avoid accountability.
Yeah.
That it's sad. It's really sad.
Yeah, it's devastating when you think that they're changing their ways and handling it appropriately. And then you find out, we did a whole episode on this with Colby Reddish. We did a live about the Arizona case. And some of the things that he was bringing to the table were the church not only basically won this because it was dropped, they celebrated in a press release saying, "We're so happy of the decision." And we're
so
like,
pleased.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Yeah.
You should be embarrassed. You should be devastated finding out that when they did call, the bishop did call the hotline, the lawyers told him repeatedly to not contact authorities. And he said, apparently, this is what we've been told. The lawyers said to them, do not contact authorities because you can't. Not maybe just don't because you're not required to. They were telling the bishop that you can't contact authorities, which is completely wrong information.
It is.
And allegedly they talked to him multiple times. The lawyers talked to him, the bishop, and saying, no, don't report it. And as you were saying, Katie, this continued for years. And the only reason this guy was caught was because the Homeland Security in New Zealand, I think it was, found videos that this dad was putting online of him and his children, and they tracked it down, and that's how they caught him. But because it was not reported initially the first time, he went on to abuse the next child that was born. And it just continues, and it's just so frustrating that more is not being done because, in my opinion, it's because they want to keep their name shiny and happy, and Mormons don't do bad things like this. And of course we want to protect the children and we love the children. No, you're protecting your wallet because they don't want situations like yours where they're paying $1 million in counseling fees because the bishop didn't report something. So now let's have the bishop call our lawyers to find out what we legally have to do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, it's really frustrating. It's really upsetting. When this case came out, it seriously triggered me. I was so upset. I was spiraling. I was doing so much research into the church and these abuse cases. And I then finally reached out to my parents about the whole thing. And to ask them how they felt about this. And I was extremely disappointed by my parents' response. My mother told me that, well, the church was following the law in the state. It's not a law. It is not required for the bishops to keep this quiet. They can choose to report this abuse. It's not a law. It's a privilege that gives them the right to hide it so that they're protected from any kind of accountability or legal situations in the future. But they could still decide for themselves to report this stuff. And so it's really disturbing that bishop was told repeatedly, you know, legally you can't report this. It's not true. And to hear that from my mother was a great disappointment, for everything that our family went through, for them thinking that the church made all these steps to try and make sure that this didn't happen again. And then for my mom to say, well, they're just following the law. No, they weren't. And then also my mother made the statement that, okay, but if we report cases of abuse when men come and confess that abuse, then men won't report cases of abuse anymore. What is the point? What is the point of men confessing to such horrible sins if you're not going to hold those men accountable and protect other youth and other young people or women in the church from being victimized from that person too? To just sweep it under a rug and to allow that man to continue to live at home with his victims or to roam the hallways at church or to move up in positions of the church and positions of authority, that it's just not okay. Is there a possibility that less men will confess to such things? Sure. But honestly, what is the point of confession if you're not also going to hold them accountable for it? And, you know, when it comes to confession in the church and repentance, there's a process. And part of the process is being held accountable for what you did. And not just in the eyes of God, but also making restitution to the people that you have harmed. Mm-hmm. That can't be done if the church is hiding it. It can't be.
Well, and not to mention, if they are going in and confessing, it's because they feel the need to kind of get it off their chest, or like they're ready to accept consequences. I don't know. I can't put my mind in one of a perpetrator. I don't know what's going through their head. But either way, they're not going to confess, or they're going to confess and nothing happens. So like, we're in the same boat.
Exactly.
We're in the same place. So why not make that extra step? Or even if it's not the bishop going to authorities, even if the bishop can alert the entire family so more people are aware of it, I don't know. I don't have the answers. I just know I'm really angry about it. But I know that you're doing some pretty amazing work on the front of helping victims of abuse seek justice and restitution. Do you want to talk about the things that you're currently doing in Colorado?
Yeah, so after learning about the Arizona case and doing a lot of research into the church and how they continue to mishandle abuse, I started to do some digging to see about potentially pursuing a lawsuit of my own against the church. Not necessarily about the money, but I wanted it to be extremely public. I wanted my story to be heard, to give a voice to victims who are too afraid to speak up, mm-hmm. To encourage other victims to speak up, because honestly, I feel that all of this thrives within secrecy. I think that it's important for victims to speak out, because I honestly don't feel that the church will ever change how it handles this stuff until it is brought to light. And it's going to take a lot of victims speaking out, I think. And so I was pursuing this lawsuit in Colorado. I found out that I was already way outside the statute of limitations. You know, essentially, I felt like the church was taking steps to fix these things. It's been a long time. I've gone through a whole lot in my life. I just never really got to the point of actually pursuing anything for myself against the church. But then I found that they had just opened up the CSA Accountability Act in Colorado, which essentially they changed the statute of limitations for CSA, but in Colorado, laws can't be retrospective. And so it doesn't open up the statute of limitations for people that were already outside the statute of limitations.
Only the people moving forward.
Exactly. Only the people moving forward. And so this CSA Accountability Act was opening up a 3-year window where people outside the statute of limitations could pursue a lawsuit for justice and accountability against their perpetrators or people responsible. And then one of the cases got up to the Colorado Supreme Court, and the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that the Accountability Act was unconstitutional because state law says that laws can't be retrospective. And so they all got thrown out. All these cases were thrown out. And so it's a huge disappointment. It's such a disappointment too, because we know when it comes to CSA that most people do not report this abuse until like their late 40s, yeah. early 50s, that is the average age that this kind of thing gets reported. And in Colorado, the statute of limitations was like 24. It was so young. So, you know, there's so many people who, you know, way outside the statute of limitations before they even considered, you know, the harm that this actually caused to their entire life. Mm-hmm. And so I feel that it's extremely important. I have reached out to a bunch of representatives in Colorado. I was invited to do a radio interview with Colorado Public Radio, where leading up to the new legislation, they'll keep playing some short clips on the radio about it. But I'm planning this next springtime with the new legislation to go out and testify on behalf of this new legislation. Mm. And hopefully we can get enough victims to speak out and share their stories at the testimony that we can get this law passed to at least give a short window of time for victims to step forward and seek accountability.
Yeah.
Busy with that.
That's amazing. You're really affecting actual change that's going to help so many people. And that's so brave of you, courageous of you. And I know it takes a lot of time and effort and energy, and it can open up old wounds. For you to take that on is incredible. And let me just say right now, as a shout out to anyone who may be someone who could be a part of this, be one of the victims or survivors who can help move this forward, I'm going to give you her Instagram right now so you can message her if you want to be a part of that. It's at k.wallace.art. You can message her there. I just want to open that up if someone's going, wait, that's me, I can help. So that's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. And also, before we move on to how you're doing now, another thing that we wanted to do with this episode, it's the first time we've been able to figure out fundraisers on YouTube, but we want to have a fundraiser for this specific 501c3 nonprofit, Darkness to Light. And do you want to talk about the organization a little bit?
Yeah, so I'm fairly new to this organization. My sister had recommended it to me. They do a lot of training on how to recognize and spot and how to handle CSA. They train people as facilitators to teach, you know, classes on how to do this. It's just a lot of really great information. My sister says that she first encountered this nonprofit during, it was a mom's group, and they had somebody come out from the nonprofit to give a speech on their own childhood essay, and then to also share information about how to prevent it in your own homes. And my sister is just absolutely in love with this organization. We're hoping to probably do some volunteer work with them, probably starting sometime this next year. But they're doing really good work. It's really important information.
Yeah.
And they've got a lot of great videos online on YouTube, so parents can try to learn how to prevent CSA in their own homes and how to spot it. And it's really good.
That's so amazing. This is the first time, and I'm sure I just haven't been aware of it before, but the first time I've heard of an organization who is focusing on the preventative measures instead of just the help for those who have already gone through it, which is equally as important. But I love that they're taking the necessary steps to educate the parents on how to prevent this. That's amazing. So guys, if you want to donate to this organization, you should be able to click something just within the episode where it says fundraiser and donate directly to them. So tell us how you're doing now, Katie. What's going on in your life? What makes you happy and at peace?
I'm much better in my life now. After all of the abuse, I definitely spiraled in my teenage years. I dealt with some homelessness, running away from home, addiction, just really spiraled. I was extremely depressed and suicidal. And I had planned to overdose at one point, right before my 18th birthday. I was exhausted. My whole life had been a nightmare, just one traumatic event after another. And I was tired of living. But Some things happened that caused it so that, you know, my plans in my life did not happen. Maybe it was the universe saying it wasn't my time. But I had the realization that night that it really honestly wasn't that I wanted to end my life. I just could not continue living my life the way that I had. Mm-hmm. I needed some kind of escape. I needed to get away. I needed to get away from my family, from the people that I knew. And so I kind of just overnight almost just drastically changed my life. I relocated. I got reconnected with a high school boyfriend that I was dating that I could never shake from my mind. And we pretty quickly got married and just started a new life for ourselves. And I can't say that, you know, everything was perfect, happy, shiny at first. You know, I really still had a lot of trauma. I have complex PTSD and anxiety and social problems. And so it was a difficult process raising my own kids at first. I was still kind of repeating some patterns from my own parents. And so it's been kind of a process of healing and deconstructing myself, deconstructing my trauma, deconstructing the things that the church taught me to try and develop a far healthier and happier life and family. I try to raise my children in a very different way. We're very open, lots of really great conversations. You know, nothing's off the table when it comes to discussing things. A lot less judgment, a lot less shame. Mm-hmm. And we've developed a really beautiful family. I'm really happy in my life, despite some of the mental health issues that I might have and my chronic health issues that I might have. But I'm pursuing education. I've got my degree in psychology, which was helpful in deconstructing a lot of this. And I'm pursuing a degree in art therapy, because art has been tremendously healing for me in a lot of ways, not just with processing some of my trauma, but it's also been a really great mindfulness tool for me. I have a lot of chronic health issues, autoimmune issues. It's kind of, you know, they think that there's a possibility that chronic health issues are also related to prolonged childhood trauma. Mm. So that could be. But I use art to kind of cope with all of that. I work in ceramics and painting, and I just find a lot of joy in that. And I try to spread that with others. I want to teach other people, you know, how healing art can be. I try to encourage things like resiliency. Like last year, I started a local art hunt in my county called Hunt the Good Stuff. And it's based off of a positive psychology resiliency building technique where during your day, you think of several good things that's happened to you, and you kind of reflect on those things and think of what can you do to ensure that similar good things like that continue to happen to you. And so it's a really good resiliency building technique. So with my art hunt, I send out like a pamphlet of information about that and encourage people to reach out to me and share other good things that happened to them during their day and just kind of spreading joy throughout the county. So I'm getting ready to start year two of the Art Heart, the Good Hunt, the Good Stuff. And so, yeah, I try to find joy and happiness in just everything and spread it.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Look at you turning things around.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's never going to be fixed overnight.
No.
And there is actually, that was the wrong word. There is nothing to be fixed. It's just about living a more peaceful life. And so, wow, that's amazing. I love that you are doing that through art. I've found that that's something that's a very common denominator among many of the people who come on the show and share their stories. So again, guys, if you want to check out her art page, it's k.wallace.art over on Instagram. And if you want to check out what she's doing over on TikTok, raising more awareness, talking about her story, that's Eliminating Outer Darkness, which is such a good name because it's a Mormon reference. Yeah. Outer Darkness is like their version of hell, basically, where all the apostates go. That's so awesome.
But I am shining the light from outer darkness.
Yes.
Yep.
I love it. That's so awesome. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. It's been really great hearing your story and your perspectives. And I love everything that you are doing to continue the work and help other survivors who are wanting to seek justice and tell their stories. So thank you.
No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And before we go, I need your Linda Listen, your sassy statement as a viral video with the toddler goes, or something inspirational for our viewers.
Well, listen, forgiveness comes with changed behavior.
Ooh, that's good.
Yep.
Yeah. I do always hate that whole like, just forgive. And I'm like, yeah, but what about accountability?
No. And even the church teaches that repentance, part of repentance is changed behavior. So how am I supposed to forgive the church if they're unwilling to change their behavior?
Girl, snaps for that.
Yeah.
That's what everyone wants to know. How about you guys start practicing what you preach, because they've been caught with their pants down many times and have not done anything, not even said they're sorry. Like,
yeah,
they
no
haven't even tried to say sorry.
Yeah.
Let alone change behavior. So I'm all for that. And again, guys, if you want to support the nonprofit that is helping to educate parents on how to protect their children further, that is called Darkness to Light. You can donate directly under this video on the fundraiser tab. It'll go to them. And we really appreciate you guys supporting in any way that you can, or just liking, sharing, commenting helps the algorithm, helps more people see it. Sharing this video, if you'd like, is also helpful. And let's see, what else can we talk about? If you want to come to Costa Rica with us, we are doing kind of a getaway just to clear our heads. That is live. So you can find that in the description, the link to book that. We have some merch. We have a little holiday sweater line, which I thought was kind of fun. I wore my sweater in Utah this weekend, the one that says "Too Naughty" and then on the back "For Your Cult." And it was kind of fun walking through the Walmart there and getting some funny looks from people.
That's funny.
So you can go get those from cultstoconsciousness.com under the merch tab. You can also become a patron at patreon.com/cultstoconsciousness if that's something you would like to do. Donate monthly. Our newest patrons, Lauren, Christy, and Dakota, thank you so much for your support. Again, guys, just watching the video is also a huge help. Leaving a comment for the algorithm is great. And if you like this video, I will leave 2 down here below. And until next time, follow your highest excitement, be conscious, and be well. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, it would mean a lot if you could like and subscribe on YouTube and leave a review or a comment to help with our visibility. You can also find me on social media at cults2consciousness or reach out by email at cults2consciousness@gmail.com.